5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're going to dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
After a week on the sidelines, yours truly is back and ready to dabble in sports media mischief. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. My name is Jason Barrett, and I'm the president of Barrett Sports Media. You can learn more about the company and my analysis on the sports media industry by visiting sportsradiopd.com. On this 14th episode, I'm excited to catch up with a longtime friend and former colleague, ESPN Radio's Freddie Coleman. Freddie currently hosts Late Nights alongside Ian Fitzsimmons on the network, and if memory serves me right, we either just passed or are on the verge of his 13th anniversary in Bristol, Connecticut. I'll make sure to bring that up with him when we connect later on. You know, before Freddie even hit the national stage, we shared studio space in Poughkeepsie, New York. We even crossed paths briefly in Albany, New York. So I think you'll enjoy the trip down memory lane, along with a peek into Freddie's professional thoughts on the current state of our industry. Before I tackle this week's starting point, I do want to address the elephant in the room. If you noticed a decrease in activity on the website and a lack of a podcast episode last week, it's because I had to undergo blood tests and reduce my workload per doctor's orders. Funny enough, I spent 8 hours in a hospital 2 weeks ago. I don't want to bore you with too much medical talk, but if you've ever had a bad back, then you understand the complexities of dealing with it, especially as it applies to sleeping. And then to take it a step further, when your gallbladder is causing you pain, that's no fun either. So lucky me, I get to deal with both. But right now, I'm feeling a lot better. I'm not yet 100%, but I'm on the road to recovery, and onward and upward we go. So to those of you who reached out via text and social media, I did read all the messages, and I do appreciate it. But I don't want to spend all my time talking about medical visits and my bad back and all that junk. Let's get into what really matters and the real reason why you're here. And that's sports media conversation. And I do have one thing I need to get off my chest. It's part of this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action!
What is your problem with me?
Hey, my problem is you are a hater.
Why
I would never wear a big baller shirt.
I just said, you know, if you want to work with Nike, Adidas, and Under Armour to maybe have something that appeals to women.
And going back to Whitlock, I don't think he can comment on anything but snacks.
That's a little harsh.
It's going to be harsh because he want to be harsh
so
on me.
So you disrespect women and people for their weight?
No, that's what you say. I didn't say nothing about no weight.
No, you just said that to me.
Like I told him, I'm not even worried about you right now. Keeping your lane.
Can you look
like
me
I
in
said,
the eye?
I don't want to look you in the eye. You scare me to death.
They wouldn't want to work with you anyway because you don't respect women.
I never disrespect women. But today, if you act like that, guess what? Something's coming to you.
Wait, are you threatening me?
I would never threaten you.
You said something's coming to me.
I don't know what it is. I'm not a psychic.
That on-air explosion you just heard between LeVar Ball and Christine Leahy took place last week on The Herd with Colin Cowherd. And it was awkward, entertaining, uncomfortable, insightful, riveting, and infuriating. And it needs to happen again. That's right, I'm suggesting LeVar Ball be invited back to Cowherd's program on Fox Sports 1, and I'm more than happy to explain why. First, let me be clear. I thought LeVar Ball crossed the line and made things personal with the way he interacted with Christine Leahy. He entered the studio with a chip on his shoulder, and despite saying he doesn't listen to or care what people in the media think, that obviously couldn't be further from the truth because he seemed to have a long memory when it came to Leahy's previous comments. During the course of 10 to 15 minutes, the controversial father of NBA prospect Lonzo Ball managed to display little respect for Leahy and gave FS1 more than enough reasons to justify not having him back on any of their shows. After the interview, people were split on social media about whether or not Cowherd should have kicked him out of the studio and rose to the defense in a stronger fashion in support of Leahy. Some, though, defended Ball, saying Leahy had provoked him previously and was getting a taste of her own medicine. But what really caught my attention was when Leahy said later on that she didn't feel Ball deserved a future platform on Fox Sports 1's airwaves. Now, if I were in her shoes, I'd absolutely feel that way. She has valid reasons for it. Unless you've been the center of attention of a major national media storm, it's impossible to understand what she's feeling and dealing with. Many will argue that with people like LeVar Ball, we're highlighting attention seekers who simply raise the volume and utter ridiculous comments while ignoring professional people who make positive contributions to advancing our on-air sports conversations. But that's where I feel many of us need a reality check. Whether we like it or not, America is made up of many Christine Leahys and LeVar Balls. We have polished professionals who think before they act and shoot from the hip noisemakers who speak without thinking. We serve content to doctors and attorneys, as well as construction workers and fast food employees. We engage the highly educated as well as the uninformed. So before we start issuing edicts about who deserves a place at the table, we need to remember a few key things. TV hosts have invited terrorists, murderers, pedophiles, and some of the lowest form of scum on television for decades. In some cases, they've even risked their lives to secure interviews for the benefit of the audience and their network's ratings. When controversial subjects and polarizing people appear on programs, the public watches. You know, the same people who claim to not want those type of characters being offered a public platform in the first place? Secondly, when we engage with uncomfortable and arrogant people, there's a 50-50 chance of the situation turning sour. If it goes that way, who do we have to blame? Ourselves. Because why? We invited it. If you need a reminder, flash back to Megyn Kelly and Donald Trump's uncomfortable standoff last year during the Republican debate, or watch the sit-down that occurred between Bob Costas and Vince McMahon, or Jim Rome and Jim Everett. Have we forgotten what business we're in? We're in the entertainment business. We feature people on our shows who help us create interest, chatter, and discomfort, and we use those moments to generate regular viewing or listening. When it's done well, ratings increase, advertisers spend more, and we all enjoy a better living. The last time I checked, nobody got physically harmed during the LeVar Ball interview. Bombastic guests have a tendency to say and do crazy things, which is exactly why The Herd had Ball on the show in the first place. Tensions may rise, people may get pissed off, but they're often worth the price of admission. Let's not forget, these type of hothead characters are not new. Do I need to remind you of Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson, Charles Barkley, Drew Rosenhaus, Allen Iverson, Bobby Knight, A-Rod, John McEnroe, John Rocker? Hello? I could go on and on. When cocky, unfiltered personalities speak, additional microphones and cameras are necessary. We can preach about the decay of society and complain that we should be living in an outside-the-lines world instead of trying to keep up with the Kardashians, but there's a reason why Colin Kaepernick, Tim Tebow, Terrell Owens, Barry Bonds, and Johnny Manziel capture our attention more than Tim Duncan, Ray Allen, Mike Trout, Barry Sanders, and Andrew Luck. America tunes in for the bad boy. Always has, always will. We love chaos, controversy, swagger, and unpredictability, yet we also want to fix it every time we recognize it. LeVar Ball is just the latest Johnny-come-lately. He's a pawn in the game, the media's new favorite toy, the car crash we can't look away from. His presence produces instant noise, headlines, clicks, views, and listens. You know, the things that every talk show is after. Many are going to take to social media and express why he should never be offered more time on sports television, yet they're the same people watching his second appearance and delivering passionate 140-character diatribes that sound similar to their first verbal meltdown. If you're Jamie Horowitz and the executives at Fox Sports 1, and you're tasked with increasing buzz and tune-ins to your programs while competing against a sports media juggernaut like ESPN, it makes way too much business sense to bring back LeVar Ball. Eric Bischoff coined the phrase, controversy creates cash. Right now, Fox Sports 1 is sitting on a gold mine. When the public asks for a car crash, you find two cars and make sure they collide. It's not always about what feels good, sounds smart, or is morally right. It's about what moves the needle. And right now, whether we like it or not, LeVar Ball is doing that. I know Colin and Christine are smart enough to recognize that, and they're strong enough to handle it. This story will be topical for the next 30 days. After that, it'll subside until the NBA regular season rolls around. FS1 finds themselves in a predicament. They have to decide if they want to milk this cow for all it's worth or search for something else. But if history has taught us anything, when good milk is there for drinking, you grab your glass and refill it as many times as possible. Let me know what you think of LeVar Ball reappearing on The Herd. You can find me on Twitter at SportsRadioPD, or you could email me at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. It's now time to bring you this week's sports media conversation, and it takes place with a good friend of mine, ESPN Radio's Freddie Coleman. I had the chance to pick Freddie's brain on the current state of the sports media industry, LeVar Ball, the changing climate at ESPN, plus we went back in time to our early days together in Poughkeepsie and Albany, New York. I think you're going to enjoy it, and I'm pleased to bring it your way right now.
And now, our feature presentation.
All right, Freddie, so I've got a ton I want to get into about your career. I'm going to do that in just a few minutes. But first, I want to start off talking about LeVar Ball, his recent appearance on Colin Cowherd's show. I'm sure you've either seen it or heard it by now because we all pay attention in the media business to what each other does. Despite this guy being cocky, arrogant, and somewhat of an ass, his appearances, though, generate a ton of interest. And if you look at it solely from a business perspective, he's doing what we want, moving the needle. So I want to ask you where you stand on him in that blurry line of bringing on a guest that might help the show gain traction, yet may not always sit personally well with you.
Yeah, that's one of the things I think you have to deal with when, if you're going to think about putting LeVar Ball on any show or any network that you're a part of, because he clearly understands how to brand himself and get a lot of attention, and as you say, move the needle. I just wonder at a certain point what price paradise, because there's going to come a time where he's going to say something that's going to bring down your show. It may not bring down your network. I don't think we can go to that extreme with him. But it's going to be something where the payoff is not going to be what you are looking for. We know he's going to generate attention, but at a certain point, when does that attention become something of a negative aspect of why you're bringing him on? Because what else is he going to say that's going to generate heat other than going after somebody who's more of a name than he is and who will be more of a name than he's ever going to be? The one thing I said about LeVar Ball when this all happened, I said, if you don't want to hear from him, then don't put him on. You don't give somebody like him what he wants, because he wants that kind of attention. Now he knows that anytime he says something, somebody's going to want to bring him on, especially if they're trying to get attention for their show that may be lagging in the ratings or lacking in terms of visibility. So if you're going to do that, you have to realize that if you bring that genie out of the bottle, at a certain point, you're going to have to deal with everything that goes with it, and it may not be what you want, but more importantly, it may not be what your listeners want.
The challenge is when you're ESPN, it's the big giant of the sports media industry, they can afford right now to say, you know what, we're going to pass on LeVar Ball. If you're the upstart trying to make some headway, you have to take some risky chances like this because it generates some attention and buzz. And look, you've sat in that chair. You know when you're sitting with a hothead opposite you that the thing could go off the rails and become embarrassing to you and the brand in a hurry. So what do you do from a host standpoint to make sure that you're satisfying the audience and keeping them talking and listening, yet not having this thing blow up in your face?
You can't back down with a guy like that, because what's the old line, Jason, that if he's a shark and they smell blood in the water, look out. At that point, you're going to be chum. If LeVar Ball knows he's dealing from a position of strength, and he knows that somebody will not be able to push back against him, he's not going to stop. He's going to keep going. I think the minute that you put him in a place where he can't get from underneath the truth, that he can't get from underneath that rock, I think you'd be amazed how contrite he's going to be, or how much more of a hothead he's not going to be in that situation. That's how I've always dealt with people, that it's okay if you're going to be a hothead, you're going to lose your mind. But if you're not answering my question, if I'm trying to get to the truth and you're trying to dance around the truth, you're going to make yourself look worse. You're not going to make me look worse, because I'm not going to give up on that. I'm going to keep hammering away at you until you either give up and say, I don't have an answer, or here's the truth, here's what it is. And then I bring you back to my terms, because we know the old line that the interviewer is not supposed to be the star. But that doesn't mean you give the interviewee all that power to the point where he's going to rule everything. You want that person to become known. You want people to get to know that person. But that doesn't mean that you have to be put on the defensive all the time so he or she can get what they want. That's the one way I would handle LeVar Ball. I'm not going to back down from him, because we know he's not going to back down, especially if he believes and understands that he's dealing from a position of strength.
I'll tell you right now, anytime that guy appears on a show, it should be sponsored by Advil or Tylenol, because that's what the audience has by the time he's done. Obviously, the national picture is a lot different than small market radio. You've seen that side of the business, too. You started in Portland, Maine, moved to the mean streets of Poughkeepsie, New York. For those listening, Freddie and I actually worked in the same radio building in Poughkeepsie, although we worked there during different years. He then started appearing as a frequent guest on an afternoon show I was producing and then later went on to host. Jay Reynolds was in the same building, as was Mike Breen. Kevin Connors and Brian Kenny did local TV, so everybody knew everybody there. But I want to ask you, you know, from the standpoint of working in that small market, trying to cut your teeth, learn the business, what did you learn on the local level that you carried with you to the national stage today?
One thing I've always learned, that it's one thing to be creative, but you have to do it in the proper space. And what I mean by that is, in the Hudson Valley, we don't have any pro teams. We're not too far away from New York, not too far away from Boston, not too far away from Albany. But outside the Hudson Valley Renegades, the summertime baseball team, there's really no team that is a pro team that people can say, that's our team, that represents this area. So when high schools were done and summer rolled around or there was a lull, you really had to find stories or find things to talk about that were going to keep people interested. And it couldn't just be a default mechanism to say, okay, what are the Knicks doing? What are the Yankees doing? Yep. What are the Rangers doing? That couldn't work, because at a certain point, people can get that listening to New York radio or watching New York sports because they could get the New York channels in the Hudson Valley. That's the one thing I learned. Okay, what can we do that we can have fun but also get what we want out there, get that story out there, get our opinion out there? And that was something that we really, really learned, whether it was you or me, Rick Zolzer, a buddy of ours, Mike Breen, Kyle Doty, who now works at ESPN in the network integration department. You learn really, really quickly how to find things that people might not think about or people might not have thought about, and you bring that to the forefront. That is something, Jason, that has really helped me, because there are plenty of times I'll see something and I'll say, man, I thought that was pretty interesting, and if I thought that, then maybe somebody else will feel the same way. So that's the one thing I really learned being in the Hudson Valley. There are going to be items you can find that can help you. You got to take the time to find it, be creative about it, but make sure the payoff you get at the end is that, look, we thought this was interesting. We believe you would feel the same way too.
Why do you believe it's important for broadcasters to experience a small market before getting a big break?
Because you figure out not only how to deal with a different market or people in that market or people that you work with in a different market, Jason, you find out a lot about yourself. You find out what works and what doesn't work. And the one thing I tell people all the time is that you have to find out exactly what's going on in your market. You can't just be this outsider if you didn't grow up in Portland, Maine, or in Poughkeepsie, New York, and say, well, I'm going to do what I want. I don't need to know about what's going on here. That's a quick death sentence for people not to pay attention to you. You can have the most compelling content in the history of mankind, but if people feel they can't relate to you because you're not relating to them, no one's going to give you the time of day or pay attention. So that's the one thing that I learned in any market I worked at. It doesn't matter where I was going to find out the flavor and the vibe of that market. I found out in the Hudson Valley, not only were they big in the high school sports, but there was a big audience in terms of Army sports and Marist basketball and even Vassar, for crying out loud, even if it's just a little pocket, but that people are interested because that was in their area. The minute you were able to find out about that, and if somebody did something well and you covered it, all of a sudden you could take them outside of that box and they were going to follow you because they knew you were going to come back and give due attention to what was going on in that area and not just push it to the wayside.
You know, the other thing I always tell people is you find out, A, how much you really love this business, because you don't get paid peanuts. You are asked to do 7 jobs. You know, there was a time where I know you worked inside the building with WPDH. I would host a wrestling show, literally tell my co-host, so what do you think of that? And while he's talking, I'm screening a phone call while running the board, getting ready to go to the call and do the show. And, you know, when I got to ESPN Radio and they tell me, just produce the show, and you're going, wait a second, I don't have to book the guests, do the production, run the board, none of this stuff? You sure? I could do all that. And now all of a sudden your mindset is become great at one thing rather than worrying about stretching yourself thin in 7 spots. But if you've went through that, then you're going to just be a lot more prepared. It's kind of what you talked about with having to create content out of nothing. When you get to a national stage and someone's bitching about a February day where things are slow, you're like, hold on, man. I've worked on a high school level with one story to run 3 hours. You come back to me and complain when you have that on your lap.
Jason, I'm glad you mentioned that, because having that kind of versatility is just crucial and essential in what you're going to do. I'll never forget so many nights and so many days where I had the camera and the equipment on my shoulders, working first with Media One and Cablevision, and just seeing different angles how to cover a story. I'll never forget one time covering a Marist basketball game, and Tim Murray, the athletic director of Marist, he walks into the building and he sees my feet sticking out from under a huddle where the women's basketball players are. And he said to himself, did Freddie die on our court? Nobody told me. But what I was doing was I was lying on the ground pointing the camera up while the young ladies were huddling, and they were going back and forth and back and forth. I just decided to do that because I figured, you know what, if it doesn't work, then it just hits the cutting room floor. But if it does work, that's a really cool thing to have open up the shot in terms of the highlight that we were going to use with Marist basketball. You don't get a chance to learn that at the national level because you have so many people doing different jobs. One person in charge of this, one person in charge of that. When you're in a small market, you really got to figure out how to budget your time and say, I can do this here, but I got to make sure I got to make time for this here and make time for that here so everything comes together and you don't feel like you're missing anything. I would not have traded that experience of figuring out and doing those kind of things for the world, because now I've gotten to this national stage and I've been there 13 years, and there's nothing they can throw at me that I can't say, I'm not doing that. I can say, well, hey, I can make that work, because I had to make a lot less work to try to make it a worthwhile sandwich, a worthwhile plate, so people can understand that and digest it and make that work for them, who I was viewing what we were doing at the time.
Now, aside from sharing history in Poughkeepsie, we also have crossed paths in Albany, New York.
Yeah.
For those listening, I moved there to join this show, which was called Waking Up with the Wolf. It was a morning show, rock station on Pix 106. And I worked with a good friend of ours, John Tobin. Tobin was, at that time, creating a local sports talk show in addition to his morning show on Fox Sports 980, which was inside the same cluster. And John reaches out, asked you to become part of it. I was initially asked to join him, but unfortunately, management decided we don't want to piss off the wolf, so I had to let my former assistant Marlena help you guys out. Did cross paths with you a few times with giving a bunch of phone numbers to help you guys with booking guests. This, though, was your first experience of hosting a sports talk show 5 days per week for multiple hours a day. What did you learn from that experience with John in Albany?
The one thing I learned was that you can never, ever let callers dictate your show. They're supposed to be a part of the show. But we never went into a show thinking, okay, when are we going to get calls? I hope we get calls. And especially in Albany. Albany is such a fascinating, great market in terms of you have Yankee fans here, Red Sox fans here, Mets fans here. You have Packers fans here. You have Cowboys fans. You have Giants fans. You have Jets fans. You have Bills fans. It's a really cool melting pot of so many different sports fandoms that are in that area. So you couldn't just rely on calls. But the one thing that we learned about in that area, it was so sports loving, it was so sports heavy, that even if something happened locally, it would catch people's attention. But they weren't put up by you talking about national stuff that were catching people's attention. I'll never forget one time where there was a story where Calvin Murphy was being investigated for child abuse, and we found out that he had 14 different children by 9 different women. Now, Calvin Murphy is not from the Albany area, but when we put that story out there, we just put it out there saying, hey, man, you got to have more responsibility of this. This is a Hall of Fame basketball player. I don't know if we made it interesting, but we brought passion to it, Jason. And the next thing we knew, the phone lines lit up. And we said, if we didn't solicit any call, the segment would have been worth it, but the calls added to it have people's opinion on it. That's the one thing I learned in that market was you got to go out there and you got to be compelling. I wouldn't want somebody to listen to any show I do and say, man, I'd be glad they have a call or seven because this guy's terrible. I wanted people to listen to John and I to find out what we had to say. And if you wanted to chime in, that was great. You and I grew up listening to WFAN and other radio talk shows locally or nationally. How many times we wanted to hear from Doris from here and this guy from Rego Park, but we listened to Mike and the Mad Dog and those guys, Russ Salzburg, on WFAN. But I learned that, well, I'm listening to Russ Salzburg. They just happen to be a part of that, not the show. And that was the one thing that I really learned that has really helped me at ESPN Radio. The callers are great. The interaction is great. I want people to feel they can interact with the show. But when you tune in to Freddie and Fitz, you want to find out what Coleman and Fitzsimmons have to say, not Pat from Florida or Jason from New Mexico or anybody else out there wanting to interact.
You know, one other thing that I think you're discounting that you learned in Albany is that you never know who's listening. And, you know, this is something I tell young broadcasters is, hey, when you're on the air doing a show, you think that, you know, you're just going through the motions. Your off segment could be the segment that John Skipper happens to be driving through your town listening to. And you went through this because Bruce Gilbert took a cruise through Albany, New York, happened to stumble upon your show and became aware of you. I had just joined ESPN Radio in Bristol, Connecticut, left Albany, and I get summoned into an office and I'm asked, hey, what do you know about this guy? Because Dave Zaslavsky, a guy we know, a former boss of ours, had said, hey, Bruce, this Freddie Coleman guy, I think Jason knows him. They just work together. So I get brought in and I'm asked, you know, what do you know of him? I'm like, yeah, this is easy. I could reach out to this guy right now. And Dave at that time wanted to, you know, before he was signing off on game night and Louise, they wanted to know, who is this guy? So they asked me to reach out to you. Do you remember that demo you sent me?
Oh, I remember that demo because it was completely, completely terrible, number one. I just wanted to get something out there just so you could have it, and I felt I could go from there. And I'll never forget you called me back and said, yeah, Freddie, I can't give this to Dave and Louise. They would have my head, and they wouldn't trust me with anything ever again. So I'm glad I got a second chance to send out a better demo, and that worked out well, because you learn stuff like that when you're thinking, okay, I'm just going to get something out there to Jason, and Jason will be able to speak up for me. But Jason is like, look, I can't have my reputation put at risk because you decided to send me this.
Well, what it is I'm like, hey, listen, I could sell you. I have no problem selling you. I just know that you're already up against it, given that you're in Albany, New York. Then on top of it, they're going to go, how long has this guy been doing talk radio? Well, a few months, but he's a great guy, trust me, and he's excellent. And eventually they're going to look at me and say, you've only been here yourself 3 months. I don't know if you really have the evaluation skills yet to tell us who should be on the air 6 hours a night. And so finally, you got me another piece. I bring it to Dave. Dave's in the production studio. He says, come on in here. We're going to listen to this. And I'm thinking, please let this one be good. And Dave goes, it's not that great, but, you know, again, he's in Albany. He's doing it by himself because Tobin was off that show. And so finally, I said, look, man, I'm telling you, bring the guy in for a weekend. If it doesn't work, nothing lost. You send them back, and that's it. And eventually they did. And do you remember who you worked with that weekend and what we were working with from a topic standpoint? Because it was pretty rough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was John Seibel and also Sean Salisbury, and it was the Indy 500 weekend. And I know for a fact that you were really concerned about that because you have to talk about it because at that time it was still newsworthy to talk about the Indy 500. And another thing, working in a small market, you got to find whatever you can that you can talk about that's going to be compelling. So there are going to be plenty of times that you got to talk about something that you may not be well-versed in, but what kind of broadcaster are you if you're not doing your homework, at least have some kind of knowledge of something, and don't go out there and sound like a buffoon. And I've been a gearhead, so I have my father's a gearhead. We watched the Indy 500 growing up as a kid, so I knew enough of the racers and the history of the race to understand exactly what I was getting into, and I wasn't going to step on the toes of John Seibel or Sean Salisbury, but I was not just going to be silent and not know anything about that race. So I don't know if that convinced people, whatever that was, but I said, I have nothing to lose here. So what am I going to go in there and be afraid, and I'm going to talk about this and know exactly what I'm talking about and have facts to back up my opinion and not the other way around?
I got to tell you, I remember because I knew you well, and you were coming in, and I'm looking at it going, man, we've got auto racing and horse racing to work with, and we're doing 6 hour shows, and this guy's got to audition with Salisbury, who takes you in 17 different directions, which is a lot of fun, but at the same time, when you're talking horse racing and auto racing, this thing could get out of hand. And you come in and I'm going, oh man, I don't know if Freddie's gonna do well here. And you're like, are you kidding? The Indy 500 and horse racing, I love this stuff. And I'm going, are you serious? Either A, you're really full of shit and doing a great job of convincing me, or B, you really know this stuff, and you did. And by the end of it, Salisbury's on the air championing your cause, claiming that, you know, executives signed the guy to a contract. Seibel's happy. The big challenge when you went through that was you had to do 18 hours of talk radio in 3 days, and that's tough. I mean, you do a three-hour-a-day show, that's 15 a week, and that's not as long. How did doing a six-hour show prepare you and help you to grow as a talk show host and carry through to what you're doing now?
I'll tell you what, I look back on those game night days with you when you were producing us, guys like Jeremiah Crow, Amanda Gifford, who's now part of the talent office, started as an intern with us, working with Chuck Wilson and Doug Gottlieb and Jack Arute and John Seibel and people like that. I mean, I look back at those days fondly, Jason, because when you do a six-hour show, you really learn about pacing. You really learn about direction, because you can't just go out there and be fire and brimstone the first hour. You're not going to have anything left for the 8 o'clock hour, much less the 11 o'clock hour, the 12 o'clock hour. Although, and you'll testify to this, because we did a six-hour show, that show really got interesting about 11:15, 11:30, because we were punchy and we didn't know what we were going to say at that standpoint, and tempers would get short a lot of the time, depending on what the subject matter was. But that kind of stuff was really cool, because once you were done with it, you never had to question, boy, did I bring it to the table? Did I give 100%? You had no choice, because it would definitely show, no matter what time somebody was listening. If they listened the first 3 hours, or if they listened the first hour, came back the last hour, people would be able to tell if you lost anything. If your fastball went from 95 to about 88 miles an hour, if they were lying your curveball, you had to rely on your slider and your changeup. So that's the one thing I really learned. It's okay to pace yourself and bring that passion and take people up here, then bring them back down here and change speeds here and there. That was one of the cool things about game night, because no matter what was going on, if something happened immediately, you were on board to talk about it. And if something was not going on at that point, you relied on the stuff you talked about in the show meeting and had that in place to have that and keep you going and keep that pace and keep that direction. So anytime I look back at game night, I never looked at it as a six-hour marathon and, oh, my goodness, that was too long of a radio show. I'm kind of glad that was the first radio show that got me started at ESPN Radio, because you really understand exactly what you can, what you can't do, how to relate to your co-host, and sometimes we have two and three co-hosts at the same time. That really prepared me for doing a solo show. That really prepared me for doing the NFL on ESPN Radio, in which color analysts, football analysts, would be changing every hour, and they would bring a different perspective. If I didn't have Game Light as that baseline, I first got the ESPN Radio, I can't even imagine what kind of radio personality I would be right now, or if I still would be at ESPN Radio at this point after 13 years.
You know, the other thing it teaches you is to adapt to different personalities, because you were working, you know, one night you could be with Doug Gottlieb, the next it's John Seibel and Sean Salisbury, then it's Michael Kim, Scott Reese, Greg Brinda, Mike Shope, Mark Madden, Jack Arute. I mean, every week you had no idea who was going to work, and you knew somebody really good would be in there. You just had to learn how they work. You had to learn their intricacies and where to jump in, where to sit out. And so, it's definitely challenging. And some of those guys, and it's something I'll get into later in this conversation with you that I definitely think has helped you, is the fact that you're working with some hosts who are working remotely, which is something you've had to do with Ian. So, I mean, those things for sure. 6 hours, you mentioned pacing. I remember before you signed on, I worked one shift with a guy who was literally falling asleep at 11 o'clock. He was falling asleep in the commercial breaks, and I'm looking at Seibel going, we've got two more hours, and he's out. What am I going to do here? And so you learn a ton of things when you're dealing with a show that long. I want to touch on one thing, because when you've been someplace for 13 years, you're going to see change. When you look at how ESPN Radio was in 2004 and where it is now in 2017, what would you say are the biggest ways the network has evolved and maybe not evolved?
Well, I think the one thing we evolved is that we have more diversified voices, and that's something that I wanted to ver- if that was ever going to happen, because we should have more chance of people to be heard, whether they're black, whether they're white, Asian, Hispanic, female, older, younger. You should have different perspectives,
right?
And it shouldn't just be the same perspective. Not to say everybody sounds the same, whether you're white or black, but sometimes it's good to hear something that you may not have thought of because you're not used to hearing it. So I'm glad that we've been able to see that, and that's kind of been an evolution of ESPN from that standpoint. The one thing that will still continue to bother me is that how much TV can interfere with what we're doing. And that's not to say they don't know what they're doing, but I'm kind of glad that we're getting back to radio more than ever before, because it's okay to be cross-platforms and have that cross-platform mentality. You want to make sure your product is on as many platforms as possible, whether it's digital, radio, TV, deportes, whatever. I'm completely okay with that when it comes to the business cycle and the business model of ESPN. But I think we have way too many instances where we had TV people who didn't understand what we were doing on radio and interfering and upsetting what we were trying to do in the day-to-day process. And I wonder how much of that kind of brought our progress back a little bit. And I know that there were people that we worked with that decided they had enough of this, and they decided to move on to somewhere else where they didn't have to worry about that kind of interference. I don't think we're seeing that as much anymore because people understand that TV is one separate thing. And the reason we're all here is because of what SportsCenter did at ESPN television. Right. We completely understand that. That doesn't mean that because you're able to do well on TV that you can do well on radio, because radio is more of an art form than television. You can see what somebody looks like and have a visceral reaction to that right away. But on radio, you really have to have an intimate relationship with that person. And if you don't like that person, you're going to find somebody else that's going to bring that kind of relationship to you. And I think way too many TV people that were in charge of putting their hands to radio kind of not even lost sight of that, Jason, but did not have any idea what that was all about when it came to the radio side. So now we're starting to see a little bit of that radio come back where people want to listen to radio and not have to worry about it being simulcast on TV. Leave that for somebody else if you believe it should be simulcast on TV. But we're getting back to what radio has been all about, that intimate connection that you have with the listener, that somebody can relate to you. And they don't have to agree with everything you have to say, because if they did, I'd wonder if something is wrong with them. But they're going to tune you in because they want to know what you're all about. They want to know how you feel. And they're not interested in what you look like or what kind of clothes you're wearing or how you're working well, having your clothes coordinate with somebody else on TV. They want to know what you're all about because they believe they can find out, you can find out what they're all about, and that connection is going to be established and it's going to stay there.
I'm going to share some history with you that's going to age you for a minute, but it really is going to blow your mind. In 13 years, you've managed to outlast Colin Cowherd, Dan Patrick, Doug Gottlieb, Eric Casilius, Sean Salisbury, Scott Van Pelt, Mike Tirico, Danny Cannell, Chuck Wilson, Mark Schlereth, and George Sedano, and you'll soon pass Mike Greenberg when he moves on to TV. So what the hell is the key to your survival, man? Because that's an impressive list of people that have been there, and you're still ticking.
I don't know what the key is, but I'll say this. You and I talked about this before. You can only be who you are. You can do what you want to do, but you have to be who you are. And for a little bit, to be honest with you, I kind of got lost in that, where I felt I had to be this person, I had to be that person, I had to be like this to impress somebody else. And then I said to myself, you know what, if it's not going to work here for me, I'm going to go down my way. And that's not being a rabble rouser, that's not trying to upset things and get on people's nerves. But I honestly believe the reason I got high was because of who I was. That's why you took a chance on me. And Dave Zaslavsky and Luis Cornette and Bruce Gilbert allowed those chances to be taken on me. I decided, you know, why am I trying to be something or someone else? And then I'm really not going to know what the hell is going on or what the hell I'm supposed to do. So the minute I decide I was going to be me, and you're going to get Freddie Coleman 100% no matter what, and I can live with the result, I was amazed how many doors were no longer slammed shut in my face, and that people gave me an opportunity to do those things. And even if somebody didn't think I was good enough for one opportunity, they thought I could make it work somewhere else or with somebody else. So if that's a key for me, is that I made that point. You know what? I got hired because of who I was and what I was all about. Why am I going to go away from something that was able to have me and sustain me throughout all these years, no matter how small the market was or how national, how big the stage was? The minute, Jason, I made that decision, and believe me, I made it about 5 years ago, I knew I was going to be able to survive in this business, whether it's at ESPN radio or not. And from that point on, I didn't have to worry about getting in my own way or having people get in my own way. That disappeared. That completely dissipated because people knew what they were going to get from me, and they knew it was going to be quality, and they knew it was going to be credibility. And yeah, I'm not going to be perfect. Nobody is. But I'm going to be 100% me no matter what or who I was going to be working with.
You talked about how some of those doors began to open. And obviously, if you're there for 13 years, someone thinks well of what you're doing. While a lot of change has taken place, the network has kept you installed during evening hours. Now, some will tell me that that's because you fit like a glove at night. They love your energy and personality at night. That, though, doesn't mean you couldn't handle or excel in a bigger weekday spot. You mentioned how things changed in your head about 5 years ago. Were you at that time allowing a lot of thoughts to creep into your head about not cracking a daytime lineup? And are those thoughts still in your head today?
I definitely allowed that to get in my head because I was thinking, okay, other people are getting these opportunities. What am I doing wrong? And then it got to the point that, and we know this, someone can hear something in somebody and think that person is good, or they don't think that person is good, or they think that person can't work here, can't work there. So if I'm going to be a nighttime radio personality, there are a lot worse things you can be in our business. For example, you could be an unemployed radio personality in our business. So I'm kind of glad I don't have to worry about that time slot, being an unemployed radio personality practicing at home, hoping to get a job. I'm glad I don't have to worry about that at this point in my life. And I said, you know what, if I'm able to create this – and make this work for me at night, where I'm part of setting the news for the next day. By the time you listen to Mike and Mike or Dan Levitard, everybody else, Ian and I have already talked about that at night. We've given you our opinions on it. So that gives us credibility because we're starting everything as opposed to morning shows or midday shows. So I decided at that point, you know, working at night and being in the middle of everything, that when something breaks, I'm on it and I'm right there on it. People respect it. I'm going to give you what you're looking for, maybe something that you did not expect. How's that a bad thing, doing that on national radio, especially on network radio? And believe me, some of my peers who I respect, for example, Scott Farrell, who used to do Farrell on the Bench, now is a great guy working for CBS Sports Radio, or Jason Smith for Fox Sports Radio. We've all had conversations about that, saying, hey, what is the problem with us doing it at night? Because somebody has to do this. Why can't it be us? Why can't we let people know that, hey, Charles Barkley and Shaq got into it? Or, man, did you see that game between the Ottawa Senators and the Pittsburgh Penguins going almost into overtime? Or, man, oh, man, the Boston Celtics had the Cleveland Cavaliers and let them get away. We get a chance to be on top of that before anybody else. How is that a bad thing, whether it's local radio, regional radio, or national radio? And the minute that those thoughts left my head about trying to impress people to get a higher slot or a better slot, quote-unquote, those things didn't worry about it anymore. And now people look at me and say, yo, we didn't leave him Friday at night because he's not interested in doing a daytime slot, mainly because he's killing it at night and he's not interested in trying to work further up. Now, if that opportunity comes along, Jason, if they believe I can do something like that, I'm not going to turn it down. But I'm not exactly trying to put my footsteps somewhere else just to prove to people that I'm worthy. I know I'm worthy by what I do each and every night, Monday mm-hmm. through Friday, for 3 hours a night on ESPN Radio.
Well, in your current role, you're working opposite Ian Fitzsimmons. The two of you guys have formed a really nice chemistry together on the air. How would you describe the show to someone who hasn't heard it or maybe has only caught snippets of it here or there?
Well, if you ever thought that a Yankee and a Southerner cannot work together on radio, you would be sadly mistaken. But the thing about it is with Ian, and Ian and I have known each other for 6-7 years. I mean, Ian guessed it when I had a chance to do radio shows before. So it wasn't as if we were completely foreign to each other. But the one thing that we've always have made a central part of this show, we're going to listen to what the other person has to say, but that doesn't mean that we're going to acquiesce to that person. And it's very easy when you're hosting with somebody that you have to worry about either stepping on their toes or you have to worry about maybe hurting their feelings by having an opinion. Ian and I have never worried about that because we know that we're grown men, that our feelings are not going to be hurt. So we have a back and forth. We're disagreeing. We're not going to be yelling and screaming on top of each other. You know, that's just child's play. We're not in a sandbox doing that kind of nonsense. And that may work for other people, but that's not going to work for us. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to be passionate. That doesn't mean that we're not going to have fun. That doesn't mean that we're not going to be entertaining, because we're going to be all three of those things. But we don't feel the need to look at each other and say, okay, I have to top Ian in this segment, or I have to top Freddie in this segment. No. That's not going to make a good show. And at a certain point, if you have that, you're going to build resentment if a person feels that way, and then you got another whole set of problems that you got to deal with night after night. And the most important thing is you have to like who you work with. I can't even imagine how Mike and the Mad Dog did that all those years towards the end of their cycle, where they couldn't even look at each other, where they were not even having any conversation with each other. And I said, boy, you guys are doing this for 5.5 hours a day, and there's no comunicado between either of you, but you're making this work. That would be hard for me to do. I applaud people that can't do that. I'm just not one of those people. So when you have that life with somebody and you're going to trust in that person and you're going to respect their opinion and they're full of you-know-what, you're going to tell them and they're not going to take it personal, that's the kind of show people get night after night from both of us, because we know it's a radio show. We would love to cure cancer, but that's not our job. Our job from 11 p. to 2 a.m. Eastern time is that you get us, we're going to get you, but you're going to get all of us no matter what's going on, no matter who's saying what.
I want to talk to you about some company stuff. Much of the past 2 years, the company's been criticized heavily in the media, which is drastically different from the ESPN that both of us grew up loving and the way many people have portrayed the company over the years. When you look at all the ways that negative attention has been drawn to the company in recent years, why do you believe that narrative has changed and it seems like many are rooting for the company to fail?
Because you get too big for a certain point, people want to bring you down a peg or two. I mean, Jason, we've seen that with IBM. We've seen that with celebrities. When you get to a certain level and people believe or have the perception that you're just too good, of course they're going to try to take bites out of the apple. We're no different at ESPN than anybody else. I mean, I remember when ABC was ruling the TV airwaves in the late 70s, and people started taking a bite out of them because they were too big for everybody and their success was too much for people to ignore. We're not any different than a guy like Tom Brady, New England Patriots. Oh, as I call him Captain America because so many people got to have an opinion on him. And the minute that he got to that level where he's going to be considered the greatest ever, that people are going to try to take him down a peg or two. It's all about trying to level the playing field. And we're not going through anything different than anybody, a big corporation, a big personality, has not gone through in the history of the world. I mean, Jason, crying out loud, they took down Jesus Christ. And we know we're not bigger than Jesus Christ. So for anybody to say that, hey, ESPN, it's about time you guys fail, I got news for people. ESPN is not failing. Of course, nothing is going to last forever. I would love for Prince to still be alive or David Bowie to still be alive. I would love for Bruce Springsteen to be at the height of his powers like he was in the late 70s, early 80s. But that's not going to happen because time marches on. You got to be able to adapt and to adjust with an ever-changing climate, and especially when things are more fluid than ever before in our business. It doesn't matter if it's TV, radio, whatever that is. It's always going to be a fluid situation. ESPN is no different. And anybody inside the company, if they did not think we were going to have to adapt and adjust, then they had their heads up there, you know what, for not believing that. And you can't. We were able to adjust and be a bigger company when nobody saw that coming. Nobody saw ESPN coming back in 1979. Nobody saw ESPN radio coming not too long ago. But here we are. And everybody had to adjust to that and to adapt to that. So why would we think at ESPN or ESPN Radio or anywhere else under that worldwide leader umbrella that we're not going to have to adjust to an ever-changing climate? That's just how the world works. So if people want to take shots at ESPN, they've done it before. They're going to continue to do it again. But the thing that ESPN is going to fail to the point where they go under in a day or two or a year or two, you know, if you're holding your breath, you can breathe right now because that's not going to happen anytime soon and probably not anytime later.
Well, speaking of adjustments, you grew up on SportsCenter much like myself. I think most of America grew up on that show, and it was the show of record that you took your tone from when it came to your sports conversations. Obviously, they're going through some of those adjustments and trying to figure out how to move their brand forward. Why do you feel the show has had a harder time in recent years of commanding the same buzz, awareness, and viewership that it once had?
Because of technology, and let's be honest, when you have 3 million channels, somebody's going to find something that they want to watch and want to pay attention to. And that doesn't mean that the SportsCenter brand is a bad brand. It's just that there's more competition than ever before. And you had to have known that that was going to happen at a certain point. Not to say you had to predict that, but at a certain, when people looked at what you were able to do at a SportsCenter brand, what's the old line, Jason? Imitation is a serious form of flattery.
Yep.
And that everybody was going to do that, especially on a national level. I mean, when Fox Sports took over the NFL and did different things, we saw so many people copy them. ESPN, they come up with the camera, the remote camera above the whole field. Everybody started doing that. Those things were going to happen, that if you're doing something that people like and people want to have, of course they're going to try to take that away. Prime example, I've seen more embrace debate on CNN and MSNBC and CNBC and Fox News than I ever saw before, especially in the last year or so, mainly because they looked at what the First Take model was and they decided, well, if that worked for those guys, why can't it work here when we're covering current events and more events that people are going to be connected with when it comes to a news cycle? That's not any different than what's gone on at ESPN. When they see something with SportsCenter and they say, hey, that worked for them, why can't we let it work for us? Of course, that's going to erode away what you were able to have a handle on because there's more competition than ever before. SportsCenter is not bad. It's still good with guys like Scott Van Pelt and Steve Levy and John Butchergross, Stan Verrett and Neil Evans and Michael and Jamal, what they're doing with SC6. But because there's so much competition, if people don't feel they're getting what they want within a 2-3 minute cycle, they're going to go find somebody else. You have to hope that they don't do that or hope that they come back to what you're doing on SportsCenter.
Yeah, you know, look, competition is good. It gives everybody in the business a reason to perform their best. It also opens up doors for others to have opportunities if things aren't progressing. And for the viewer, it's great because you got a ton of things to choose from. That said, commanding that major audience is going to be a lot harder when you've got 100 places to choose content from as opposed to one or two. And look, we'll be having this conversation in 5 years. With Facebook.
Yep.
How come it's not the dominant player it once was? Well, because others are invading the space. It's part of the reality of the world. world. And I thought your summary of it was excellent. And you brought up something I want to hit on, which was First Take. Because radio work aside, you've had a chance to make appearances on that show. Many, as you know, are very split on the embrace debate phenomenon. But clearly, if you look at the numbers, that model has worked. And you just cited some of the examples of how other television networks have copied it. So having sat in that chair and worked on that show, why does it work?
Because people love to argue, and people think that they know more than everybody else. I mean, Jason, you and I are political guys. How many times have people said, I could be a better president than President Obama or
yep.
President Trump?
Yep.
We've heard that constantly because people look at Stephen A. Smith or when Skip Bayless worked there or Max Kellerman now or Will Cain, and they always, man, those guys are full of you know what. I know more than them. If you have people that feel that way, of course they're going to tune in. Look at what Paul Feinbaum does in the afternoons. The reason he gets so much attention from callers is because each caller believes they know more than the fool that just called Paul Feinbaum about 5 seconds ago. Those things are going to be trademarks of what we do in our business. I guarantee you, as much as people enjoy what we do on radio, there's always going to be those people that say, man, Freddie Cohen's full of you know what. I know more than that clown. And if people are paying attention to what you're saying and having an argument in their mind about it, then you got them. You're going to bring them in. They're going to feel connected to what you're doing, whether they can't stand you or not. And believe me, that show has taken hits from so many critics around the country and so many critics that are even inside of our own building, for crying out loud. I guarantee you there are plenty of people at ESPN that may not like First Take or may not like the people on First Take. That's fine. You can have your own opinion on that. But the reason that show works is because there's always going to be somebody or plenty of bodies that believe they know more than somebody else. It's a prime example that you work at a job. If you believe the guy's in charge of you or the woman in charge of you doesn't know anything, what's the first thing you say in your mind? Man, they don't know anything. I could do their job better than they can.
Yep.
It's the same principles, whether it's SportsCenter, whether it's First Take, whether somebody watching a football game. I mean, how many times we see Joe Buck get criticized on Twitter? How many times have you seen Chris Collinsworth get criticized on Twitter or John Gruden get criticized on social media? It's because there's always going to be somebody out there that believes they can do your job better than you can. I'm okay with people feeling that way because that means that they're passionate about what you're saying and they agree with it or disagree with it or they believe they can say it better than you can. That's fine that you feel that way. I think you're wrong, but it's fine that you feel that way because I've done this a little bit longer than a lot of other people out there. But as long as that mentality is there, you're always going to have that work.
You know, the amazing thing about it, I mean, obviously from the host standpoint, your job is to strike a chord with the audience. Stephen A., Skip Bayless, they do that extremely well. And the reality is, if you look at these shows, First Take, Undisputed, pretty soon Nick Wright's getting his opportunity with Chris Carter, Dan Le Batard, all of them, what are they? They're sports talk radio shows doing television. It's just fancier
yep.
production. We've listened to this on Mike and the Mad Dog for years. We've listened to this on The Michael Kay Show. You name a show, everything they're doing is essentially a debate on a discussion of the topic of the day. And it's just amazing to me that it took so long before this became a bigger focus on television. But again, back to adjustments, and that's what we've gone through. One thing I want to ask you, though, about First Take, because for all of those people, when you mention about how people do like to argue, and I agree, they like to argue and debate everything, what would you say is the one aspect of that show that people misunderstand?
They think that everything is staged. They really, really do. And for the longest time, when I would fill in and I would be on there with Skip and Stephen A., people would clearly say that, okay, Skip and Stephen A. are staging those arguments, right? They don't really believe that. And I'd say, yeah, they do. I mean, that's something I think a lot of people have tried to put next to those shows, and they believe they're just doing that for shock effect. And I said, you know what? Skip Bayless was like this when he was writing for newspapers. He hasn't changed. He just got a national forum, a national platform for his views to be out there. Same thing with Stephen A. Smith. Stephen A. Smith probably has been like this since he was in a sandbox playing with the kids in his neighborhood in Queens, New York. That he hasn't changed. The venue has changed. The environment has changed. But Stephen A. Smith has been the same person. He's been that same guy that's going to let you know exactly where he comes from. Max Kellerman has not changed in the days that he was covering boxing. He's the same guy. I think that's what people fail to understand. No one, you can tell when somebody's doing shtick. It's clearly, at least I can clearly see it. But the guys that we're talking about, they've been the same people. And that's the one thing that people seem to forget about First Take. They don't have to stage anything to get you to watch, because that's who they are. If they believe passionately in something, they're going to dig their trenches and they're not going to hold anything back. The difference is, compared to previous years, they're not doing it in a newspaper. They're not doing it on a local radio show. They're doing it on a national platform with more eyeballs paying attention to them and more ears paying attention to them. So if anybody believes that stuff is being staged, that Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith are saying something to try to get on your last nerve, they're going to get on your last nerve anyway. They did it before. The difference is now they're doing it on TV and not just doing it for a newspaper.
That's great. I appreciate the insight on that. And you're right. That is always a conversation with people. They're always curious about whether or not those guys believe what they believe. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can't fake authenticity. If it's real, it's going to come through. And at some point, you're attached to whatever you say. So Stephen A. and Skip have made a great career out of being very opinionated, and they're going to continue to do what they do. I want to wrap up on something that I call quick hits, which is a couple of quick questions. First thought that pops to your head. What would mean more personally, a New York Jets Super Bowl win or a Knicks NBA title?
Knicks NBA title. I waited too long.
The best instruction you've received while working at ESPN was?
From Bruce Gilbert, who says, "I want Freddie Coleman. I don't want anybody else."
The broadcaster who inspired you to most want to pursue this business was?
Art Rush Jr., who was the first black sports talk show host I've ever heard of and is a pioneer in New York that nobody knows about.
And if Freddie Coleman had the power to bring back one ESPN ex-colleague from those last 13 years back to the network, who gets his call?
John Seibel. He was the first guy I worked with. He's still one of the favorite people that I've ever worked with. If I had a chance to do a show with him again, that would be all right with me.
Congrats on all the success. You can hear Freddie and Fitz weeknights on ESPN Radio from 11 to 2 a.m. Eastern Time. You can follow him on Twitter, at ColemanESPN. Great to hear your voice, my man. Wish you the best going forward, and excited for you.
Jason, always a pleasure to talk to one of my best friends in the business, one of my best friends outside of the business, man. And glad for all your success as well, the podcast and everything else, and you be well, partner.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
I hope you took a few things away from that conversation with Freddie Coleman. I thought he was very candid and accurate when talking about the changing climate at ESPN and the perception of First Take. But what I really enjoyed and have a good understanding of is the way he's grown as a professional. It's easy in this business to get caught up in the things you don't have and to allow your competitive juices to flow and make you feel like you're being disrespected, overlooked, and underappreciated. But when you step back and evaluate your situation and compare it to what others are working with, as Freddie did a few years ago, it allows you to find inner peace and enjoy what you do more. It's okay to believe you deserve a bigger stage, and I'm not suggesting anyone should accept the status quo and settle for less. But before you stress over everyone else's real estate, you sometimes need to take a look inside your own walls, because often you'll find you're the owner of beachfront property and thousands would give up everything they've achieved to have one day in your shoes. Really good insight that Freddie provided on that conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. That's going to bring this episode to a close. My thanks again to Freddie, as well as to each and every one of you for taking the time to listen. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast on iTunes, and help spread the word by sharing the content on Facebook and Twitter. To those of you in the industry who program stations, oversee clusters, or own and operate companies, I work as a sports radio consultant and strategist. Details of my background along with industry references can be found on sportsradiopd.com, but I invite you to reach out. Let me know what your challenges are. I work with large markets and small markets, and I'm sure I can customize something that will produce results for your brands. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.